I told you the night was a glittering night, and looking around this room, you can see why I said it. It is a magnificent audience, and thank you very much indeed for coming along and supporting the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Victoria. I would like to say, because I won't get a chance later, how much I appreciate the work of the committee in putting this together. The Honourable Jim Short and his committee have done an absolutely fantastic job in bringing this about. Jim's a persistent sort of a fella, and he's timed it down to the last moment, and he's kept me up to the mark and informed me all the way through. So Jim, to you and your colleagues, thank you very much indeed for a splendid job. And thank you to our special guests, because they have had an immense lustre to us. I am here to apologise on behalf of the National President, who's overseas representing Australia yet another time. But we do have the National Vice President, Zara Kempton, here. And we also have Melissa Connolly-Tyler, who is the Chief Executive of the Institute in Canberra. So we're delighted to have you along as well. Now, we have the oration. What a marvellous phrase that is, isn't it? The oration. The Sir Zelman Carr Oration, to be presented by Mr. Dennis Richardson, AO. Now, Dennis Richardson, who's sitting just over here and nervously waiting for his introduction, because he doesn't know what I'm going to say about him, is probably one of, not probably, certainly, one of Australia's most significant public servants. He's had an outstanding career serving successive governments. He was chief advisor, I found out tonight, to Bob Hawke at one stage. He's appointed Secretary of DFAT in early 2010, following his return to Australia after 4 years as Australia's ambassador to the United States of America. Prior to that, he was for 9 years the Director General of Australian Security Intelligence Organisation. Previous positions included Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration and Multicultural Affairs, a department which is a significant trainer of public servants, and Principal Advisor to the Prime Minister in diplomatic appointments in Jakarta, Port Moresby and Nairobi, among a number of other prominent international roles. He was made an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2003 for his services to Australia. And he's going to give us tonight his views on foreign policy in a changing world. We're delighted to welcome you, Dennis. Would you please welcome Mr. Dennis Richardson?
Thank you for that, Michael. It's a bit daunting here tonight because there are a number of people in this room who I've worked for, and it's never good standing up giving speeches in front of people who you've worked for, because they mark you, you see. And Jim Short, Jim, thank you for organising tonight, and it sure as hell beats appearing before you in Senate estimates, which I did on lots of occasions. Michael, as president of the AIIA here in Melbourne, Sir Ninian and Lady Stevens, Sir James Gobbo, Mr. Meyer, really sincere congratulations for your award this evening. Distinguished guests, it's a genuine honour to be asked to give a speech named after a really great Australian in Sir Zelman Carr, and I hope I can do justice to him. I'd like to thank the AIIA for its invitation. I think the work that you do here in Melbourne and around the country is quite fundamental to national public policy debate on matters of foreign policy, and we don't always have a lot of that here in Australia. In tonight's address, I want to focus on some of the big global changes we're living through, Australia's strength and interests in that changing world, and some of the bigger challenges we might face over the next 20 to 30 years. First, a disclaimer. I was invited to give this address some months ago and provided the title of the speech quite a while back. So my remarks should be seen in their own right and not within the context of the review of Australia and the Asian Century announced a week or so ago by the Prime Minister. My address does not seek to preempt that review. Now to the first question, how is the world changing? The best response I've heard to that is a speech at a recent National Security Leadership Forum by Alan Gingell, the head of the Office of National Assessments in Canberra. We're good mates, and he gave me permission to extensively plagiarise what he said. In the 10 years before 9/11, if the 10 years before 9/11 were marked by the end of the Cold War, the triumph of globalisation, and the merging of domestic and foreign economic policy, in the decade afterwards, it was the amalgamation of domestic and foreign security policy that mattered. We've just lived through what might be termed the national security decade, a period in which most governments, including Australia's, fundamentally revised their ideas of what national security is, who is responsible for it, and how it is done. We live in a world in which economic power and all that flows from it in terms of strategic capability is shifting from the Atlantic, where it has resided since the Industrial Revolution, back to Asia. The reasons for this are complex, but they boil down to the great interconnected threads of the information revolution and the other technologies which drove the development of global supply chains and global finances, all coupled with the power of demographics. At its simplest, this is the story of China's rise, which is now well known and documented. China's rise was reinforced by the global financial crisis, and that crisis hasn't yet played itself out. So our biggest short-term strategic uncertainty by some distance is the global economic outlook. This has political, social, and strategic consequences. It is an open question whether advanced economies have the fiscal strength or the policy repertoire to respond well to any new and significant global downturn. So fiscal consolidation combined with weak growth and high unemployment in the United States and Europe is likely to increase social and economic strains and may spur protectionist sentiment. China, it's true, still has a lot of untapped potential. Between now and 2030, more than 200 million rural Chinese workers are likely to move to cities. But as China shifts from an investment and export-led economic strategy to one based on consumption, it risks more volatile growth. We're in unfamiliar territory. A world in which emerging economies are driving recovery while developed countries lag is one we haven't experienced before, and we don't know where it might lead. One of the clearest ways in which we're seeing global power shift is through its impact on the institutions the world uses to organise itself. Multilateralism is in a period of complex transition. Organisations like the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, and the G7 are under structural pressure. And the WTO is struggling with paralysis in one of its pillars, trade liberalisation. Newer forums like the G20 and proto-groups of the emerging powers like the BRICS, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, reflect this new order. But nothing is yet fixed and the whole system is in flux. That leaves a gap in global leadership. As we've seen, and climate change negotiations are just one example. None of the newer powers wants to take on the sort of responsibilities for global stability and sustainability that have been mainly borne by the United States since the Second World War. So we may need to adjust to a world where states end up competing less over who seeks to shape the world than over who manages to avoid bearing the costs of doing so. The next few years will be a critical period for the United States, but America's superpower status is not at risk over the short to medium term. For all its problems, the US still possesses a combination of strengths unmatched by any other great power: the flexibility of its capital markets and the productivity of its economy, its innovation and technology, its centrality to the global financial system, and its continuing population growth through immigration. But Washington is under much greater global scrutiny than it was 12 months ago, as it faces tighter fiscal and strategic restraints. The US is only slowly coming to grips with the need to rein in its massive fiscal deficit and maintain its competitive edge. President Obama's strong focus on domestic renewal won't diminish his commitment to maintain US global primacy. Though as it juggles many pressing priorities, the US will look for much more help from allies such as Australia. In East Asia and globally, the US-China relationship will remain the most critical, even as both sides struggle to keep it on an even keel. What China does and says, and what it doesn't do and doesn't say, is an ever-growing part of the economic and strategic diet of many states. And China's maritime assertiveness in the South China Sea, for example, will spur more clashes with its neighbours and perhaps the US. Miscalculation can't be ruled out. China's leaders see domestic instability as their biggest problem, and they believe that solid economic growth, low inflation, leadership unity, and zero tolerance for organised opposition are the answer. But they also believe that military and other power projection capabilities will protect China's broadening strategic interests and deter US intervention. Japan is still a major power and a key player in the world economy, but looks set to keep slipping in relative and absolute terms. But Japan will remain a major power and a critical trading and investment partner for Australia. We should not forget that. And Europe does not simply belong in the past. The most worrying challenge in East Asia remains, of course, the North Korea and its nuclear program. Russia will remain a nuclear superpower, but its economic and demographic challenges are immense. India's economic and strategic rise probably now has enough momentum not to stall in the next 10 years. Serious structural problems may constrain its economic growth, but its importance to Australia and the world at large will continue to grow. Closer to home, Southeast Asia should remain stable enough to sustain reasonable levels of growth. But with patchy governance, and perhaps with the exception of Vietnam, its emerging economies won't emulate the blistering takeoffs of Singapore or the Northeast Asian powerhouses. The good news is that intelligence-led law enforcement operations have degraded regional terrorist networks, confining Islamist extremism to a fringe phenomenon. Due to sustained pressure from security forces, Indonesia is safer from terrorists than it has been for a decade. But terrorism won't be stamped out anytime soon. Small, tight-knit extremist groups remain and can be expected to strike from time to time. And separatist conflicts, especially in the southern Philippines, help breed the conditions in which terrorism can regenerate. Among the countries of Southeast Asia, Indonesia matters most. Its transformation over the past 15 years has been remarkable. It is in Indonesia's own interests that it continues to embed democratic traditions and maintain solid economic growth, but it won't be without its challenges. The most volatile area of the world stretches from the India-Pakistan border through Afghanistan, the Middle East, to the Horn of Africa. Within that arc, intractable conflicts, nuclear-armed states, endemic poverty, major power competition, and Islamist terrorism will all come together. It has long been relevant to Australia. Since 1948, there has been no year in which Australian military forces haven't been serving in some capacity in the Middle East. And look also at our commitment in Afghanistan. The region will continue to be a major source of demands on and hazards for Australia, ranging probably from requests for involvement in conventional war, peacekeeping and humanitarian missions to irregular immigration. The protest movements that recently erupted in the Middle East and North Africa are unlikely to run their course in the next few years. The region may be just as messy and complicated in 2020 as it is now, and no less of a global preoccupation. The Arab Spring has probably encouraged Iran's determination to build its influence in the region. Its Islamic revolution is underpinned by distinctly Persian nationalist ambitions. Tehran sees itself as a major power and wants the clout to go with it. That helps drive its nuclear program and its support for armed groups in Lebanon, Gaza, and Iraq. For Australia, both the subject matter of global politics and the players in it range beyond individual countries. Pressures for cooperation and competition are increasing across the range of what is sometimes called the global commons. The high seas, outer space, the climate system, and the connective tissues of cyberspace. The headline transnational challenges, terrorism, cyber, organised crime, people movement, and climate change will persist and change shape rather than diminish or disappear. And more actors are now involved. New technologies have empowered groups and individuals ranging from pirates to fraudsters, from people smugglers to computer hackers who can now have a real impact on state power. Cyber power is becoming an important dimension of state power, including for Australia, helped by the cyber dimension of our alliance with the United States. If it's integrated with other kinds of power, cyber power can have more pluses than minuses for us. Australia is well placed in this changing world. We have quality human capital and natural resources. With our LNG, coal and uranium, we are already a significant energy exporter. We are also a significant exporter of agricultural produce. So we have a lot of what the world will want in the 21st century. Our trade and investment patterns are diversified globally. China, Japan and Korea take just over 50% of Australia's merchandise trade. We have completed a remarkable agreement for trade liberalisation and closer economic integration with the 10 ASEAN economies. Our inward and outward investment and financial flows are becoming more diversified, but remain dominated by the United States and member countries of the EU. And we have expanding economic interests in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. All up, Australia is not as small as we like to think of ourselves. Compared to the United States and China, yes. Relative to others, no. Our challenge is not to punch above our weight, but to punch up to our weight. Of the 193 countries that make up the United Nations, we are the sixth largest in land area, the 13th or 14th largest economy, and about the 50th most populous. In other words, of the 193 countries that make up the United Nations, about 140 have a smaller population than Australia. We have the 13th or 14th largest defence budget in the world, and within 4 years we will become one of the 7 or 8 largest aid donors in the world. What we also have is a proud record of international engagement, both globally and in our own region. From the establishment of the UN in 1945 to the Cairns Group to the prevention of mining in Antarctica, and of course Sir Ninian Stephen played a big role in that, to APEC to the G20. From the support for Indonesia's independence in the 1940s to the Colombo Plan to ASEAN's first dialogue partner to Cambodia to East Timor. What we don't have is a natural weighty grouping such as the EU or ASEAN. Our history has consistently been to be put in what can only be described as the others, as in the West European and others group in the UN. Hence, our bilateral, regional and global diplomacy does need to be active and creative, as it has generally been over the decades. Prediction is always difficult, but the following are some of the big challenges which I believe Australia will be confronted over the next 20 to 30 years. The interrelationship between the United States, China, Japan and India will provide the backdrop and centre point to much of what unfolds in East Asia and beyond, just as the Cold War provided the backdrop and centre point to the second half of the 20th century. As a middle power, we have a national interest in the embedding of regional architecture, such as the East Asia Summit, which provides a forum for the open discussion of all issues and which continues to embed the habits of consultation, something which ASEAN has been so successful in fostering. Making the existing architecture work effectively is fundamental to peace and prosperity in the wider region. With few exceptions, our East Asian and Southeast Asian neighbourhood will probably become wealthier and more confident. For the first time, we will have a neighbour in Indonesia which will have a bigger economy than our own. This will require a psychological adjustment by Australia, as will an Indonesia which continues to embed democratic norms. We will need to rethink engagement strategies and expectations. The changes in East Asia challenge our capacity to become genuinely Asian literate, not just to talk about it, but to do it. It ought to be a cause for concern that our education system has become less, not more, able to support that necessity. In DFAT, we see it every year in our recruitment drives. But others have spoken about that, and here I can add little to the critique. The bureaucracy also needs to relearn the fact that knowledge of another country is highly relevant to advice and decision-making which materially affects another country's interests. And DFAT needs to be more robust in its advocacy. The changes in East Asia, both economic and strategic, will see a real growth in regional defence expenditure. This will not be directed against us, but it will mean that the capability gap we have traditionally enjoyed in the wider region will significantly diminish and in some instances probably disappear. This in turn will raise questions, not now, but well down the track, whether we will be able to continue to meet our defence needs with just under 2% of GDP. EU countries and Canada are in different strategic circumstances, so we should not look there for comparisons. None of this should be seen in dramatic terms or in terms of growing threats. Rather, it is a natural consequence of countries getting richer and modernising their defence capabilities in the process. We will not be able to ignore that reality. But the growing wealth of East Asia will not be shared across much of the other part of our neighbourhood, the South Pacific. Here, climate change and other constraints may present us with opposite challenges to wealth and confidence. Over time, that could lead to serious questions of labour mobility if some of the smaller South Pacific Island countries are to develop sustainable economic growth. Beyond the immediate neighbourhood, we have yet to develop a genuine strategic partnership with India, and our trading relationship with that country remains far too narrowly based. So the potential for growth is great. It is important that we see our recently commenced economic partnership discussions with India, and with Indonesia for that matter, as having implications in returns beyond trade. That may not sit well with economic purists, but it is our challenge in today's world. At its simplest, as an open economy and middle-sized power, Australia has an interest in a rules-based international order, broadly supportive of the free flow of ideas, goods and services. It is in our national interests that the UN functions more effectively and that over time it is reformed. As a body which provides the basis for our presence in East Timor and in Afghanistan, and as a body which provides the basis for our sanctions against Iran and North Korea because of their nuclear programs, it is only reasonable that from time to time Australia seeks a temporary seat on the UN Security Council. If we take its resolution seriously, we should take its membership seriously. And if we take its membership seriously, we should be prepared to play our part from time to time. Beyond the UN and its various agencies, some of which provide enormous value, we have other global forums. None is more important to Australia than the G20. The G20 provides the best hope for the global economy managing the existing challenges within a broadly coordinated cooperative approach. That is why in 2008 we argued hard for a G20 leaders meeting and against the G13 or G14, from which we probably would have been excluded. And that is why the Prime Minister, the Treasurer and the Foreign Minister continue to be so actively engaged today. Should the G20 fail, it would likely be replaced by a grouping of which we would not be part, despite our economic size and success. In such circumstances, we could not count on any other country to effectively represent our interests, neither the United States, nor Indonesia, nor any other. For the first time, the G20 has provided a relatively small global forum in which Australia shares the table with a number of countries with which we have not historically had deep and broad-based relations, but which are becoming increasingly important on the global stage. Chief amongst these are Brazil, Mexico, Turkey, and of course India, and in certain respects South Africa. So the G20 provides an opportunity not only to pursue global economic interests, but to develop key emerging bilateral relationships. Take, for instance, Brazil. Destined to be one of the world's biggest economies within a decade or so, and already a major player in international forums, we have no historical or other natural starting point for our relationship. Until recently, it has largely stagnated. And even today, our diplomatic presence there reflects the world of 40 years ago, not the present, let alone the future. To varying degrees, the same could be said of Turkey, Mexico, and South Africa. In conclusion, I would make two additional observations. The first concerns the fact that I have not sought to cover all the bases. There are many relationships and issues important to Australia over the coming decades which I have not mentioned, Vietnam and Antarctica being two diverse examples, but I wanted to draw out themes, not the waterfront. My final observation concerns prediction and global and regional changes over the coming decades. Whatever our views and certainties now, the totally unexpected, the black swan, is the one certainty in an uncertain future. We do not know what or when, but we do know it will be something which none of us can see today. That may be obvious, but it is only by being conscious of the certainty of the totally unexpected that we can keep an open mind. And only with an open mind can you retain the flexibility to respond sensibly to the big surprise, to the big shift which changes the fundamentals. And that ultimately is a true test of foreign policy professionalism in a changing world. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now have the very welcome addition of Tony Walker to the rostrum here. Tony Walker, who is the international editor of the Australian Financial Review, is in fact the person that no Australian international journalist has devoted more time to reporting, analysing and commenting on global issues. He's been everywhere and he's been around for quite a while, and I can't think of anybody better to provide the appreciation for that address that we've just heard. Would you welcome Mr. Tony Walker?
I'm not sure, given my height, that I have to stand on the podium. I'll stand on the bench. Thanks very much, Michael, for those remarks, and I'll have a great deal more to say about Dennis's excellent presentation. I'd like to acknowledge a former Justice of the High Court here this evening, and perhaps a one and a half justice of the High Court, because James Gobbo told me before that Malcolm Fraser had invited him to join the High Court, and he graciously declined. Of course, he went on to be a distinguished governor of this great state of ours. I'd like to also acknowledge former ministers of the Crown, including Michael McKellar, the Honourable Michael McKellar, and the Honourable Jim Short, who have done, with their helpers in the Institute, a great job, I think, in revitalising this organisation. I'm sure you'd agree. I'd like to also acknowledge former senior diplomats, including Richard Woolcott, who served with distinction in many parts of the world. Distinguished members, I'd like to acknowledge, of the business and philanthropic communities, frankly with emphasis on the philanthropic part of it. And I'd like to note the presence here of the Meyer family. I had occasion recently for a Financial Review magazine cover to do a genealogical study of the Meyer family, which was quite a challenging assignment, I have to say. I learned a great deal about them, and my respect for them grew as a consequence. I'd like to also acknowledge my esteemed colleagues from the Fourth Estate. I see a small fraternity over there. And also my fellow Melburnians. It's great to be home after leaving the city in 1974 to report from Canberra on the Whitlam government in that remarkable period in our history. I could tell you any number of stories about those moments. Some you might have difficulty believing, but that's not our purpose tonight. if you looked at the photograph of the dismissal, though, you might notice a tousled-headed reporter immediately to Whitlam's left. For years afterwards, because as we know, Whitlam has a prodigious memory, he would say to me, "Comrade, are you maintaining the rage?" And I would say to him, "No, but I'm treasuring the memory." My task, which I embrace with enthusiasm, is to offer an appreciation of our keynote speaker and to provide thoughts on his address. I do this with great pleasure because, inasmuch as journalists, especially those of us who believe in journalism's adversarial role, are capable of mutually agreeable relationships with public officials, I can safely say, Dennis, you and I have had such a relationship. Note, I'm avoiding use of the word friendship here because I don't want to compromise Dennis's reputation or get him into trouble with his boss. I should mention his ambassadorship and my correspondentship in Washington coincided, which meant that over a period of almost 5 years, we were in touch very regularly. Those were years, we should remind ourselves, which were marked by contentiousness over the global war on terror, Iraq, and the debate within Australia about the extent to which Australian governments should align themselves with what, by any standards, was an adventurous, even radical foreign policy. In those years, we, Dennis and me, might not always have agreed. We might have had our differences. I might have received the benefit of Dennis's unsolicited advice on occasions. But I was never in doubt. He was motivated in those exchanges by what he perceived to be in the national interest. In my longish career as a correspondent, in many parts of the world, I have met few officials who approached their tasks with such clarity of purpose and were able to give expression to those perspectives so effectively in normal give and take. From a professional standpoint, these were invaluable exchanges and pleasurable at the same time. For those courtesies, if not friendship, Dennis, I thank you personally. And on behalf of many of my peers who benefited from your advice and accessibility over the years. Dennis has what I might describe as an appreciation of the value of public diplomacy, as we've witnessed tonight. And this has been apparent over a long career described by Mike McKellar in his introduction. It's perhaps worth noting here that Dick Wolcott pioneered public diplomacy to an extent in the early 1970s as a spokesman for the Department of External Affairs. Dick, is that correct? Is that what it was called in those days? And I benefited from those briefings at the time. Before going on to share words from Kim Beazley, whom I rang today to get his thoughts on, I guess, I wanted to indulge one other perspective from my Washington days. This is by way of providing context for the various important roles Dennis has performed in a long career. When I visited successive ambassadors at the Australian Embassy on Massachusetts Avenues, I would linger in front of the portraits of previous incumbents on the walls leading to the ambassador's suite to remind myself of how much our own history is entwined with that office. Starting with Richard Casey as minister in Washington from 1940 to 1942 during the Menzies-led government of that period. Then followed Owen Dixon, who took time out from his duties on the High Court to serve the Curtin government. Dixon returned to the High Court to become Chief Justice and preside over several of the country's landmark High Court challenges, including bank nationalisation and the outlawing of the Communist Party, to name two. Other distinguished representatives in Washington included the Labour politician Norman Macon, Percy Spender, regarded as Australia's outstanding foreign minister and one of the architects of ANZUS. Howard Beale, Robert Cotton, Andrew Peacock, and now Kim Beazley among politicians. Career diplomats who filled the post are too numerous to mention and include some of the country's outstanding envoys, but I think it's fair to say Dennis loses nothing by comparison with others whose portraits adorn the embassy's walls. When I called Kim Beazley this morning in Washington, he was more than happy to provide testimonial for his predecessor. In fact, he went on a bit, I should tell you. To avoid embarrassing Dennis, I won't repeat all of Beazley's generous observations beyond his description of him as being his own man. I can attest to that, and I think proof lies in the fact that he has enjoyed the confidence of both sides of politics and the Fourth Estate at the same time, and particularly the Fourth Estate. His present role serving a minority government in which the moving parts do not always operate in sync would be one of his more challenging, I believe, and would explain why there's more grey hair than I recall last time we encountered each other. Now to his speech. This was a good analytical speech that lays out the challenges facing our country in what is, as Dennis told us, a fluid environment. His reference to the potential for a black swan event, in other words, something that is potentially catastrophic and unpredictable, is a warning well made. We learn things from this speech that might not have occurred to us explicitly, but are important to keep in mind. Indonesia will become our first neighbour with an economy bigger than our own. This is something that Dick Walcott would not need reminding about. This means we need to pay more careful attention to developments there and work harder to improve our relationships at many different levels. What I like particularly about the speech lay in his analysis about shifting power relationships in the region, overlaid by the global economic outlook, which remains precarious, even treacherous, we might say. While Dennis made the point that his remarks should be seen as separate from his department's contribution to the recently announced review of Australia and the Asian Century, I found his hard-headedness on the subject encouraging. Wariness about China's growth trajectory is one of my pet themes. Perhaps I should mention here that I served as correspondent in China for 10 years, from the beginning of the economic revolution in the late 70s, early 80s, and again in the later period in the 1990s. In fact, I covered, as a journalist, the beginning of the process of decollectivization. I remember going to Sichuan province in 1980 to report on the beginning of the first free markets in China, when peasants were selling peaches and watermelons on the streets of Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan. It's hard to believe, isn't it, that just, 30 years ago, that's how it all began. Let's quote Dennis on the subject of China. As China shifts from an investment and export-led strategy to one based on consumption, it risks more volatile growth. We're in unfamiliar territory, a world in which emerging economies are driving recovery, while developed countries lag is one we haven't experienced before, and we don't know where it might lead, unquote. I think those are wise words. And we better be prepared, and perhaps avoid what I believe is a dangerous tendency. It's the China will provide syndrome, espoused by politicians, even Reserve Bank governors, that risks leading us into complacency and thus dangerous territory. Dennis dealt with the US dimension efficiently, I thought, and basically I have no problem with his conclusion that America's superpower status is not at risk over the short term and the medium term, and that for all its problems, the US still possesses a combination of strengths unmatched by any other great power. But we should, but we would be deluding ourselves if we believe it is business as usual where the US is concerned. Its economic problems and social dysfunctionality are not passing phenomena, in my view, and have implications for its ability to maintain its global primacy. It should go without saying that America's ability to overcome its internal problems is critical to our own security and economic interests. We should be barracking for wise and tough leadership. One could draw many other strands from Dennis's excellent speech, but perhaps I could conclude with one other element that struck me as being worthy of amplification. This was his observation that one of the clearest ways in which we are seeing a global power shift is through impact on the institutions the world uses to organize itself. He notes, multilateralism is in a period of complex transition, as he puts it. Referring to institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, and the G20, he says, and he's right, the whole system is in flux. This may not be a bad thing for an aspiring middle power like Australia, but a gap, or at least a flaw in global leadership where new powers are reluctant to assume responsibility for global stability, borne by the US since the Second World War, means we are indeed in uncertain times. It's fortunate, therefore, that we have officials of Dennis's calibre, Dennis Richardson's calibre, to help manage this process. So, Dennis, thank you on behalf of the Institute for your sincere efforts, and I'd invite attendees to show their appreciation in the appropriate manner.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've got one small final thing to do, and that is to get the Access Chairman to come up and present bottles of splendid wine to our two speakers tonight. Access, as Jim has told us earlier this evening, was established in Victoria to provide resources to younger AII members, to be an informal forum to encourage and facilitate debate on international affairs, and as a means to foster networking and promote professional skills development. They are enormously important to us. We value them greatly, and they do a terrific job working without pay in with the Institute, providing all sorts of additional services. Just before I go there, and this is Jason Singh, who's the chairman. He's coming up in just a minute. Before I leave the forum, though, tonight, I really would like to say a special thanks to Peter McDermott, who's standing at the back there, who has done a magnificent job not only tonight, but right throughout the years she has been with us as our executive assistant. So, Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael. On behalf of the Institute, we'd very much like to thank Mr. Dennis Richardson for his very insightful, broad and in-depth presentation tonight. And as a young person, I really appreciated listen to many of the things you've said. So thank you very much again. I'd also like to present another gift to Mr. Tony Walker for his very complimentary presentation, and thank you very much, Tony.